Welcome to Table Talk, the podcast that takes an in-depth look at the dynamic and exciting restaurant world. We sit down with industry leaders as they share best practices, highlight smart solutions, and discuss strategies for growth, ultimately helping food service operators learn how to affect positive change and grow their business. Now, here is your host, editor and publisher of Food Service and Hospitality Magazine, Rosanna Kyra.
Today is part of my special edition of Table Talk podcast series, focused on some of the impacts of COVID-19, I'm going to be examining the growing popularity of ghost kitchens, virtual kitchens, and food halls, as well as some other new hybrid models of takeout and delivery. We have three leading industry experts in this field who have taken time out of their hectic schedules to be here with us today. So first off, a big thank you to this terrific trio. Now it's my pleasure to introduce them to our listeners. First off, we have Oren Borovich, co-founder of Kitchen Hub, John Lettieri, president and CEO of Hero Burger, and George Jacobs, founder of Accelerate, a technology platform designed to help restaurants operate delivery. So as everybody knows, we've been living through one of the most tumultuous periods in our history. And during this time, many food service operators have had to pivot to takeout and delivery. But as we're seeing, takeout and delivery is starting to take on some new importance in ways that we probably could never have imagined before. So I'm eager to understand and look forward to learning more about how COVID-19 might in fact be fueling growing interest in this new off-premise restaurant model and how this potentially could become the future of food service. So welcome, gentlemen, and thank you for being here today. So I thought we'd start off just by maybe having each of you tell us a little bit about your company and what you're doing in this takeout and delivery space, as some of our listeners may not be familiar with all of your companies. So why don't we start with Oren? Tell us a little bit about what Kitchen Hub is all about.
Great. Thanks for having me, Rosanna. Kitchen Hub is a virtual food hall, which is also sometimes referred to as a ghost kitchen. What we do is we provide dedicated turnkey kitchen spaces for restaurants to do delivery, takeout, and catering business, predominantly through online channels like the third-party delivery apps like Uber Eats, Skip the Dishes, Fedora, DoorDash, and then other channels as well. We also act as a shared front of house and provide a suite of services so that the only thing that our restaurant partners need to do is bring their staff and their food and cook orders as they come in through the various channels. The biggest key for some of our restaurant partners is there's no real upfront cost for them. We outfit the kitchens completely and they don't need to sign long-term leases. Our leases start at our licenses start at 1 year.
That's a pretty dramatic shift.
Yes, absolutely. It's, you know, realizing that the upfront cost of a restaurant can be, you know, anywhere between $300,000 up to $2 million if you're a full service restaurant. We want to take that that obstacle away and really give restaurants a chance to explore new avenues and explore delivery and takeout through these online channels without having to worry about the risk of putting up all that capital and taking on loans and all of that.
That's pretty amazing, Oren. When did you start the company? How old is it?
So we've been working on the model for well over a year now, but we launched the first Kitchen Hub January 20th of this year. So we're in month four.
Wow, that's pretty exciting. Although pretty scary too. I mean, it's probably good timing for you with all of this because it really feeds into the takeout space. George, can you tell us a little bit about Accelerate?
Yeah, absolutely. So Accelerate is essentially a data analytics platform that aggregates third-party data so that restaurants can better manage and grow these different channels. I think historically, delivery has been somewhat of a black box for restaurants. So we try to open up visibility into these different third-party delivery apps and provide one central platform where restaurants can go to see things like sales, how much commissions they're paying, errors and refunds, along with a lot of, you know, public-facing data of how they're listed on these third-party marketplaces. So how high they rank, how high they're, how they're being priced on these third-party platforms. And then they can also ensure with Accelerate that that all of their listings are accurate. So we kind of provide one platform for restaurants to turn to manage and grow these channels and better understand how they're doing, both from a sales standpoint, but also, you know, listing accuracy, visibility standpoint, and provide them with these tools to actually grow on these different marketplaces.
So how long has your company been around?
We started development in mid-2019. We officially launched back in October with a small beta, and now we're working with a little over 2,000 restaurants.
That's pretty amazing in a short time, in a short period of time. So wonderful. Maybe we could go on to a definition of, I think it was Oren mentioned that sometimes, you know, a ghost kitchen, this terminology really changes across the board. Sometimes we hear this being described as a ghost kitchen, a virtual food hall, a cloud kitchen. What are the differences? What are the nuances in this space?
Yeah, happy to answer that. I think there's a lot of confusion when it comes to the terminology, and I could just try to sort out and separate the things that we're talking about for the listeners of the podcast. A ghost kitchen typically is a facility that houses restaurants that are delivery and takeout focused and sell predominantly through online channels, third party delivery apps, their own websites, and wherever else. A virtual restaurant, much like John is going to describe that he does, is a restaurant that can operate on a platform like Uber Eats or DoorDash or Skip the Dishes, where the brand and the storefront are online, but the restaurant is actually operating out of an existing kitchen in an existing, you know, traditional brick and mortar restaurant. And then a virtual food hall kind of is similar to the ghost kitchen concept, where you have, you know, facility housing multiple different restaurants. But the virtual food hall also allows customers to order from all of those different restaurants. So on one order, you could have, you know, in our case, you could have the salad from Fresh plant-based restaurant and the Thai food from Pai Northern Thai and the barbecue from the Carbon Bar all on one order.
That's pretty amazing. So you're really giving the consumer so much flexibility that previously, you know, they didn't have.
Yeah, you know, the thinking was first, how can we help empower restaurants to take on this new channel in a way that's profitable and efficient and gives out a good product end product to the consumer.
Right.
But then along that thinking, how can we provide something else that they can't already get? And so that opportunity for the consumers that are going on the platform and can't agree on what they're going to order tonight, we're trying to eliminate that situation so that everyone can get exactly what they want.
Okay, that makes great sense. And like I said, it offers amazing flexibility to the consumer. John, if I can ask you, as more of a traditional operator, you know, as someone who's come in from the QSR side, what are you doing differently now to be considered maybe a little bit of a hybrid?
Well, good morning, and thank you for inviting me today, Rosanna, and great to be on with George and Oren. So, so pre-19, we are a brick and mortars franchise model. And over the past 2-3 years, we've seen an increase in delivery. And it really happened, you know, the idea of the virtual kitchen came up. So we're traditionally bricks and mortar. And when we opened up 2 years ago in New York City, the amount of delivery, and I just went to the local restaurant next door and I said, listen, if I can give you, you know, X amount of dollars of gross sales, and it didn't cost you anything, because we didn't really do much marketing. We're on a side street on the Upper East Side. We're, you know, three in, and the delivery was unbelievable. So the whole idea of saying, okay, well, let's look what the market potentially can absorb as far as kitchens in kitchen or business in business, let's call it. So it's been 2 years that we've done a study to understand, you know, what retail landscape and what it looks like and what are the challenges. We're operators, and we and we see it every day ourselves here in house, that there's an opportunity to increase someone's sales with no extra cost. They already have a restaurant. They made their investment. They have the labor. They're up and running, and they're ready to go. And they can insert our product coming in bulk and then preparing the food, branded hero for the delivery pickup. Pre-19, we had a very strong school program and catering.
So, John, how many units would have that kind of feature available now that you're working with?
So we've done in two ways. So online only at our bricks and mortar stores, you can get our Hero Fish and Chip program. We call it Hero Seafood, our fried chicken program, and our plant-based, all branded under a Hero Seafood. Under the in Ottawa, we have a guy that has all three concepts. He's adding plant-based this week because we just added. He has two locations in Ottawa that do all. They're going to be doing all four. Kitchener-Waterloo is just doing burgers, and we've just signed up a couple more as of this week that are doing just burgers.
Wow, this is amazing. And you started this last year, you're saying, basically. So the last year, you're really...
Yeah, we did a two-year study to really understand what the landscape... Now, that was all pre-19. You know, post-19 is now we're breaking down our proteins in small boxes that people can order online to cook at home.
So, I mean, really, in terms of positioning with all this COVID, you know, situation that we're living under, it's good timing in that respect.
We were set up to do the virtual kitchen, which we already had existing pre-19. I think the vision that I had and where I think it's going forward for Hero Burgers, at least, is something that we wanted to do Q3 and Q1 this year and next year.
Right.
But now that's all we're doing now is concentrating on that. So there'll be a element of a grocery that you can also buy and the home meal replacements.
So you're launching into that as well.
Yeah, we have our own distribution and our logistics, so we can deliver to homes. And yeah, we're putting that all in place. It should be all locked, sealed, and, you know, by the end of the month. But our home meal replacements is going out next week, and our grocery hopefully by end of month.
Incredible. That's pretty exciting. We're talking about all this disruption from a technology point of view, and now with COVID-19 adding to that, how can restaurants that haven't been exposed to this phenomenon through virtual kitchens, how can they play in this new game? So if I'm a restaurateur out in the market and I'm saying, okay, I really want to get into this takeout space, but I don't know how to do it, how can they start the process? And maybe, Oren, you can start us in on that question.
Yes. So I think for restaurants that are, you know, looking to get into the new game and starting to do delivery and takeout, I think it's been pushed on a lot of restaurants as of late with COVID-19. You know, for them, it's a matter of starting to think about their business in completely different terms. You know, to start off, it's really easy. You can contact all of the apps, and I do think that that's the first place to go, is to contact the apps and start your relationships, start getting your stores up, and really explore all of them and try to go with as many as possible. And then, you know, focus on menu and thinking about your menu in different ways, because now you're creating food that's going to travel for a long period of time and not going to be eaten within 5 minutes of being cooked. And rethinking packaging and rethinking labor, because you don't need the front of house as much anymore on delivery. So, you know, take that cost out of your calculation on that side of your business, and think about, you know, what kind of staff do you really need? And really it's cooks that are the main piece of the pie here. And really, you know, what it comes down to is looking at this, in a way that you've never looked at the restaurant business before. And then, you know, if it you know, kind of post COVID-19, as you're thinking about your restaurant, if you're thinking about going into delivery and takeout, you know, we provide a platform that allows restaurants to pursue delivery and takeout as 100% of their business. And, you know, the key insight for us there was to think about rebuilding, think about the business from the ground up. And I mean, you know, by the ground, I mean, starting with the real estate. So for us, we're providing that platform where restaurants can come in. They don't have to find a location. We provide the location, we provide everything. But for them, it's the same thing. If you're not looking to go into a ghost kitchen space like ours, you know, if you are doing 100% delivery and takeout, thinking about, you know, the way that you used to think about the restaurant, your restaurant was, what's the best location? What's the best corner could I be on? With delivery and takeout on online platforms, it's not about physically where you are. It's about, you know, what screen are you on and where are you on it?
That requires a whole, like you said, thinking outside the box, because operators have never looked at that in that same way. So are you finding this liberating for operators, or is it still kind of a hard thing to get their head around? Because it is really an entirely new way of looking at it.
I think it really depends on the restaurant. You know, in the restaurants that we work with, typically have embraced delivery and takeout so much so that they're you know, they've invested in coming into our facility and building 100% delivery only and, you know, takeout business. And for them, yes, even for them, it was a little bit of a jump to, you know, understand how the model would work and how they could do things, but they're slowly starting to think in the way that they need to be successful in the game. And then other restaurants, you know, I think it is a challenge to start thinking about marketing as a bigger piece of your job. You know, I was speaking to a restaurant yesterday. They're saying, I got this great space. Cost me a lot of money to outfit it and make it beautiful. And I never needed to do any marketing at all from day one. And I had incredible sales. And you know, that doesn't always happen, but I think that's a case that a successful restaurant is more used to in the dine-in world. But when you turn on the apps for delivery and takeout, nobody knows you're there, and the chances are you're not at the top of the screen. So right. How do you let people know you're there? And, you know, how do you let people, like, how do you make people think like, oh, I want to order barbecue tonight. I'm going to order from X barbecue restaurant.
Sure. So realistically, I mean, there's a lot of new rules that are out there, you know, to play in this game. And I guess really that means a whole new set of tactics and strategies, as you're alluding to. George, can you maybe speak to, you know, what are some of those new rules and strategies from your perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, over the course of the past few years and with the rise of these delivery apps, customer behavior has really changed, and it's been a factor of a few different things. We used to think about delivery as mainly being for pizza. Now it's for all cuisine types. We used to think it was probably better for multiple people because there were delivery fees and potentially order minimums. And then these marketplaces came in and rid away with the order minimums and have very, very affordable delivery fees. And on top of that, what used to be, you know, very minimal selection from a delivery and online ordering standpoint has become almost infinite. So all of these kind of different components have led to consumer behavior changing, and the ability to adopt delivery has become much easier. And on the restaurant side, you know, you didn't used to have access to this pool of delivery drivers that you do now by way of third-party delivery. So it used to be very labor-intensive, and now that barrier has been removed. So as a result of all these different things, more restaurants are participating than ever. Delivery is growing at a very rapid rate, and consumers are starting to expect that experience. So I think, given all those different factors, it's really important for restaurants to understand that they are in fact playing in a new game, and the way that you win in this new game is different than the way that you won in the old game. Oren mentioned it just now, but when the restaurants are going to need to think about their menu very differently than they used to, and think about what foods are best consumed off-premise. The way that you market and reach customers is much different. Obviously, the footprint, if you're building a new restaurant and site selection criteria has drastically changed. And all of these, you know, different facets that make a brand successful on these delivery marketplaces might be completely different than what had made them successful in the past for a traditional or predominantly dine-in setting.
Yeah, no, that's very clear. It is really a whole new game. You know, I was doing some reading on the U.S. market, and obviously this trend has been very big south of the border. How many takeout and delivery restaurants do you think the U.S. market now has in this kind of new space? And, you know, how comparable is that to what's happening in Canada? Obviously, we're a smaller country, so the numbers are a lot smaller, but how can we compare those two?
Yeah, so I think to answer your first question around size, there was a study done mid last year that suggested about 400,000 unique restaurants in the U.S. are offering delivery. So that's you know, above 50% of the entire market. I think that number's probably drastically grown through forced expansion by way of COVID, and a lot of these marketplaces have been setting record numbers in terms of restaurants that have been onboarded and started to offer delivery. I'm not sure the exact number for the Canadian market, but if we applied, you know, some assumptions, and I think the Canadian market's about 10% of the size,
10%, right,
in terms of total restaurants. So if we applied that same logic, maybe 40 to 50,000 unique, obviously a large assumption, but I think that is probably directionally correct if you assume that market penetration in Canada is about the same as the U.S.
Okay.
In terms of a delivery app standpoint.
And I would expect that after COVID, that number may increase significantly.
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, in talking to a few of the marketplaces about their U.S. numbers and growth during this time, it seems that they're about 300% up from an onboarding standpoint. There's probably close to net neutral impact in terms of guest selection on these marketplaces, just because, you know, there's probably close to an equal amount that are shutting their doors either temporarily or some, you know, unfortunately permanently during this time. But yes, to answer your question, there's going to be some significant growth in restaurants who never thought about offering delivery, or even might have been against it in the past, that are now participating and really needing to go all in on the strategy.
Okay. So we've talked a little bit about, you know, some of the new rules. What are some of the challenges in this new delivery model, as well as some of the opportunities? So maybe, John, can we start with you on that? As an operator, you know, who's been used to doing business in a certain way, what have been some of the challenges morphing into this different kind of space?
Well, the challenge is really the insight. So, you know, to George's point of, you know, the consumer behavior, you know, if we were to sit down and say, okay, we're going to have a restaurant for the next 25 years, then we're going to open it. Well, who are we going to attract? And, you know, what is that 12-year-old right now going to look for at 22? And if you just look at where it's gone in all retail, the amount of online pre-19 was enormous. Now, this is all we have is online and delivery, but it's scoped up to every single retailer.
Right.
Curbsides everywhere, every supermarket, you know, Grace, you know, Gateway Grocery was a flop 20 years ago. Now it's probably the hottest thing in the market, you know, I'm sure. Right. So everybody's doing, every single person is, you know, looking to deliver, even outside of the food. As we know, a lot of those sectors have got hit. So what does it look like? You know, in reality, we've gone through many challenges and many wars, and we continue to prosper and go back to the old ways. So is this an internship, and what is the percentage of the stick rate? So people after 90 days have a certain habit, things are going to stick. I think it's going to be hard to get somebody in the gym when they can open up a screen, have their trainer go through something just like that. So it's a whole mindset. Now, what is the, you know, we open up restaurants, you know, we're always talking about how we're pushing out our product to get it to the consumer. You know, what is that consumer behavior and the trend of that behavior? I think now it's accelerated to a point that it was always there. It was always around. We knew it, tech, this, you know, we started these virtual kitchens. It's, you know, we got to see if it's still going to work, right? We have great success with what we have out there, you know, but we're looking to, you know, blanket quite a bit. But these are all seed, we're all, you know, we're all pioneering in this. You know, hopefully one day we'll go in the books for this, but it's really accelerated to what's going to stick in human behavior moving forward. You know, every, you know, not every, and I'm not saying I don't want to generalize that, but my peers, their 78-year-old grandmother has four things on her tablet. Call my grandkids, call my grandkids, call my kids, and call my grocery store, right?
Right.
And they've learned that. So that wouldn't have happened 3 months ago, but now they've sat down and spent days with them. So the whole consumer behavior to that point, and what does retail look like as far as walk in? I think where there's density, people will continue to walk in. You know, we're looking to our, you know, our challenge is, do we continue with this no contact? So we're working on a new behavioral approach when you walk in the store, that your kiosk, our kiosk is in your hand. Press the barcode, order your food, go sit down. We'll call you when it's ready. There's no cashier.
Right. No, interesting.
I'm probably ahead of the game, but I think the new demographic doesn't want to talk to anybody anyways.
Well, that is very true.
They want to sit down and eat. So
yeah,
all these things that are going in play that are, yeah, and like you say, very true. We know that. Now's the time to do it.
So now, Oren, from your perspective, what do you see as some of the challenges as someone who's now done this for the last year and has been exposed to a lot of the strengths?
Yeah, you know, I want to address some of the last thing that John was saying, because I think it's particularly astute right now. COVID has changed things and has fast forwarded things literally overnight. All these things that we're seeing happening now have existed for a long time. The delivery apps have been around for a few years now. Curbside pickup was there. Grocery delivery was there. The ability to order on your phone and have the food brought to you when you sit down in the restaurant was there. What John, I think that the point that John is making is, what an incredible opportunity where things that might've taken years to catch on or never have caught on, or have caught on in a big way, literally overnight. So for restaurants thinking about the future in delivery and takeout and outside of delivery and takeout, like in-house, you know, how are you going to adapt your business? We think about these kinds of things all the time. In terms of challenges in restaurant and delivery, and you know, COVID aside, this is going to be the case. This was the case before COVID. This is the case now, probably more so now because so many restaurants have come to the fold, and will definitely be the case in the future. Getting your brand out there is probably one of the biggest challenges when it comes to delivery. We're all fighting for space on the screen.
Exactly.
You open up your favorite app and people you know, tend to order what they know. McDonald's does incredibly well on delivery because everybody knows McDonald's and it's, you know, inexpensive. They provide all kinds of value. But if you actually open up your Uber Eats screen or your Skip screen, you're going to see a lot of McDonald's on that screen. And so how do you make the space for yourself? That is probably, you know, one of the biggest challenges that I think restaurants have. And the ones that have great brands, you know, they have less challenges, but the ones that are starting out from scratch, finding the way to create that message and create that space on the apps and maybe go outside of the apps to communicate with the customer in another way. I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges that faces most restaurants in this model.
That's a great point, because as more people get into the space, that's only going to be amplified, right? So you're going to get even more of that challenge being out there.
Yeah, and you know what? By and just, you know, speaking to rethinking the model, it's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity because there are a lot of channels that you can use to communicate with the customer. There's a lot out there, whether it's through the apps, they all provide some kind of way to advertise within the platform, but then also all the different channels, Instagram and Facebook and Yelp, you know, people often look to Yelp or TripAdvisor for reviews on restaurants. So there's other places that you can, you know, go and buy a little bit of real estate to help get your name out there. And for the most part, those ways of getting your name out there are fairly affordable if you compare it to the amount you would have had to spend on, you know, building a beautiful room.
And I think what's come out clearly during this time is that restaurants that had spent a lot of, you know, maybe not a lot, but some energy and focus on their systems, their online systems, they were able to morph into this new reality a lot quicker than other restaurants that perhaps were more lax on that. So it speaks to the point of how important technology and online systems are moving forward. But George, from your, sorry, did someone want to jump in on that?
Just to on the point, there's really not much difference between bricks and mortars and ghost kitchens. You still have to make the consumer know that you're there. So you're shifting your efforts and your investment into your business and making that happen. So
right.
Point, because nothing, the fundamental of the business doesn't change. You know, it's food, service, and hospitality. The question, the experience is not at the table. It's when that bag was opened up at the front, at the table, right? So just
it's a shift in mindset really more than anything.
Yeah, the fundamentals are the same. You have to give them good food. You have to tell them that you're there and you have to be able to service them and have all the marketing you do. You can't maybe not, you know, you don't have to, I think you don't have to afford billboards now. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to do it online though, but there's an investment.
So George, from your end, what are some of the technologies available to operators who want to get into this new space and, you know, what can help them to do that basically?
Yeah, so I think that there's a few main ways to enter the market. You can build a direct-to-consumer experience, which I think is critically important, or you can enter by way of a third-party marketplace or aggregator, or do both methods, which is what I ultimately end up recommending. The nice thing for restaurants is there's a lot of turnkey software solutions that allow restaurants to get up and running from a direct standpoint in a matter of days, and obviously it's pretty easy to get up on these different marketplaces. So I think before going off and building the business from a digital standpoint, restaurants ought to think about how they want to enter. And like I mentioned, I recommend doing both these third-party delivery apps because they have a lot of eyeballs and really good customer acquisition strategies. There's a lot of demand that can be generated through them. And then there's these direct ordering platforms that empower restaurants to have a direct connection with their guests. So they're accepting pickup, curbside, or delivery through their own website and their own apps. I think you mentioned the point earlier around what's potentially scary or risky for restaurants. If restaurants just have the strategy of building business on these third-party delivery apps, especially at a delivery-only capacity where digital is 100% of your business, it's a very scary world in a few years because these marketplaces and how they list restaurants and how you rank and how visible you are could drastically change, and that really can impact your business. So if you don't build that direct digital strategy, then you almost don't have a connection and you don't even know who your customers are. So I think from a technology standpoint, it's very important to look at how you can have that same great experience through your direct channels, which fortunately there are different software providers that make that easy and enable a really beautiful digital ordering experience along with plugins to these third-party delivery systems for fulfillment so that you don't have to hire your own drivers. And that also comes with things like driver tracking and other great user experiences that the third-party apps do have that historically have been more difficult to build in-house.
So when it comes to that delivery model that you're talking about, George, a lot of operators feel pressured by the fact that, you know, third-party aggregators are taking upwards, you know, of whatever, 30% on the ticket price to deliver that product. That's a huge cost for operators, obviously. And we've heard a lot of comments over the last few weeks from operators who are, you know, not very happy that this is going on during this crisis. You know, their expectation was that those fees should have been reduced. So a lot of operators already think, well, maybe, you know, delivery doesn't make sense or is not as profitable because of those high fees. Is that an accurate reality moving forward? Or do we need to look at that pricing model maybe a little differently in this new mindset shift that we're talking about?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And some restaurants that I speak with, I feel like can deceive themselves into thinking that delivery is very unprofitable because of the 20, 25, 30% commissions. And while I understand that restaurant margins are very slim, I think that too many restaurants today erroneously attribute costs that are not required to operate a delivery business into their delivery models. And it's That is kind of a scary fact, because when you're looking at the delivery business, you might say there's no profit in it, when there actually is. And the challenge is you don't need 30, 40, 50, 70% of your restaurant to operate delivery if you have a dining room. However big your dining room, you don't need that. You don't need busboys. You don't need servers. You don't need people taking orders. That's all done digitally. But if you're attributing the real estate costs associated with your dining room, the staff that is associated with interacting with your guests that you no longer need, if you attribute all of those different expenses into your delivery model, of course it's not going to look as good as if you only attribute the costs that are associated with delivery. And I think we've seen a very similar trend of this in e-commerce. And I think it's really important for restaurants to understand what costs that they actually need to operate the delivery business, and how those might change in a new P&L where labor might go from 30% to 15 or 18%, and real estate might go from 6 to 10%, maybe to as low as 2%. And then when you shift some of those costs to paying down or over at least to the commission, then the model actually looks significantly better.
Right. Well, that makes sense, because you're really, it is a whole different business. You can't compare it to the old way, right?
Exactly.
John, did you want to add to that?
I think, you know, as far as the aggregates, it's about math and economics. If a restaurant is not wanting to be into the delivery game, they don't see the expense and they look at the expenses different. If you're in the game that you want to look at, we've been looking to deliver for the past 30 years. How do I deliver? You know, we're open up 100 hours at my minimum wage, what, $13, $14 an hour? I'm $1,400 just in my labor, not my car, not my liability, not, you know, someone walking into areas that maybe I don't want my staff to walk into. If we look what happened to one of our pizza operators now, you know, the whole driving world is a pain for the operator. There's no asset to an operator to have a driver. You're going to sit there, and at least the aggregates, you have every minute of the day, you can get a new driver in front of you. So if you do the math at, you know, 100 hours, you can't be delivering when you want. Consumer today wants it all the time. So if you take that, just the hours that you're open up, 100 hours at $1,300, you need $4,000 just to say, hey, that covered my driver. If you're getting that much numbers, you have more potential to do, because you're marketing yourself different, because they're going to want it at home. And you wouldn't be able to do it without that. So, you know, the 20, 25, 30%. And if you can get 20% on an aggregate, you never do it. And actually, having your business tied into that 20% gives you more equity in your business in tomorrow, because these deals are going to go up.
Right. So it really doesn't make sense for an operator to do their own delivery, is really what you're saying.
Unless he's really at super volume. And that's all he does. Like if we're right. back to Vesuvio Pizza in 1968, they had 27 cars, right?
Yes.
If you want to go back into some history, right? Camaras had their 10, 15, 20. Every pizzeria had 10, 20 cars.
That's right. It was a different world.
It was a different world.
How about the whole notion of curbside pickup, though?
Perfect. Don't get out of my car. Give it to the guy at the front door. Yeah, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. Why aren't operators doing more of that? I mean, realistically, is that an opportunity that's been missed?
I think that the operator doesn't understand sometimes how much curbside could work. This is what kind of, you know, is really what the awakening is. Sometimes restaurateurs don't really see that people order and stand outside and expect you to run it out to them when it's kind of really simple, right?
It is very simple. I don't get that personally, but I think there's an opportunity there that's probably being missed. We've talked a little bit about cost. Obviously, the real estate cost is really the huge component here that is a lot different. How would you compare the other costs that could be saved in doing this virtual setup or, you know, whether it's a food hall or a virtual or a ghost kitchen? What other costs can be minimized? Obviously, the number of staff is different in this kind of setup, but what other areas?
Yeah, happy to jump in here. So the main cost that you'll look at is your ability to shift, like to George's point, is your ability to shift your labor cost and your real estate cost into that commission cost. You know, aside from that, when you're doing takeout and delivery, you have an opportunity to look at your menu and find the things that people are looking for and streamline so that, you know, you're very controlled and careful about what that food cost looks like. So there is an opportunity, and we, you know, we work with all of our restaurants to make sure that the items that they're putting out are allowing them to achieve a food cost that would be a lot lower than they would face in a dine-in scenario. You know, the frilly stuff and the passion. The dishes that are there because of passion and you know, for more of a marketing purpose, those tend to go away, because what people are really looking for when they're looking for Thai food on delivery is they're looking for the pad Thai. Mm-hmm. So you know, that's another area. And then in a facility like ours, the ability to share a bunch of the costs, right? A lot of people don't think about the costs that add up, the cost of waste removal, the cost of the Wi-Fi, phone systems, shared storage space. Like in our facility, restaurants can benefit from the fact that it's a shared facility with one front of house that's being split up by across the nine brands that exist within the facility. So from a cost shifting basis, there's a way to operate a lot more efficiently and achieve a profit margin that would be similar to what a restaurant would expect in their dine-in business.
Okay. George, from your perspective, is there anything you wanted to add to that in terms of cost savings?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really boils down to, there are like three major costs to operating a restaurant: food, labor, and occupancy. And to Oren's point, when you think about labor and occupancy, there's drastic reductions to operating a delivery or digital-only business in terms of the percentage that those costs make up of your gross sales. I think the only other point I'd add is that someone who's looking to start a new restaurant is an investor. They're investing their time and their capital, and the idea is obviously to get a payback on that investment. So I think one of the big components I'm thinking about opening up a delivery-only operation as well is that the present value of your investment is the value of, you know, all future cash flows with some discount rate attached, the initial capital contribution plays a huge role in that. If you have a higher initial investment, you'll need higher cash flows to get the same return. And one of the things that's very interesting from a delivery-only standpoint is that the upfront capital that's required to actually operate delivery is drastically lower. So if you're looking at the attractiveness of the investment, and whether or not it might make sense to do this delivery-only business, you can't only look at the reductions in labor and occupancy costs. you also have to look at the drastic reduction in the upfront capital contribution, which might go from $500,000 to maybe $1 million for traditional brick and mortar to, and some of these dark ghost kitchen facilities can get you up and running for as little as $20,000.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I was just to add on to that last piece, speaking with the restaurant yesterday that got started in our facility. It cost them less to get started in our facility than it cost for their silverware, their dine-in.
Are you serious? That's pretty funny. That is pretty amazing. So, I mean, from a cost point of view, it's like a no-brainer. But I guess if you're an operator too, and you know your focus has been on the menu and menu items, this really necessitates having, like you said, someone said earlier, fewer menu items. Obviously, you can't do everything that's traditionally been on your menu. Does that create a problem for a restaurant's, you know, creativity and for their menu development when, you know, maybe they need to now focus on two or three items that travel better, for example, than a slew of menu items that they normally would have? What kind of reason? Because I think for a lot of operators, that's the big part of why they want to be in the restaurant industry too, you know, to have a great menu and wonderful dishes that are creative. How do you reconcile that?
So I think the number one thing that's been missing from delivery and takeout is the innovation in the menus. To be able to provide menu items that deliver well. So there's still a ton of room to be creative and to put out new dishes. And the beautiful thing about operating on these apps or operating on online, you can put an item on within seconds and be selling that item to all of your customers, and you can feature that item and you can take great photos, and that item can be up very quickly. I think my point on streamlining was more about, you know, when you're getting started, you want to focus on the things that are going to work on your economic model. And then you have this with the room to play with the menu, to add new items, to do it from a cost efficient perspective. But also, you know, you have the opportunity to be an innovator and create that new way to send an item that previously was not deliverable because it just wouldn't travel well to a dish that, you know, is similar but has been created in a way that it can sit in a package for 30 minutes and then come out and absolutely delight someone when they open it. So, you know, there's a ton of opportunities. The opportunity to look at delivery and find ways to provide new experiences. You know, we haven't seen much in the way of packaging innovation. There's been a little bit. But you know, how great would it be to receive your delivery of Italian food in a packaging that looks like like an iPhone box, you know, that came out and really delighted you. So there's still tons of room for that innovation. I think it's just how you focus it.
You know, and also, you know, if there's more and more people actually staying home or working at home, you know, it doesn't mean that it has to be fully cooked. It doesn't have to be all cooked. It actually can be, you know, creative, you know, delivery that people are wanting to maybe take it up another notch as far as quality, or foods that need to be heated right away and they can just throw it in the oven. You're going to get a meal in 30 minutes. What you do with that afterwards, it's just that's how you want to position yourself in the market, make the consumer aware about that, right?
That's a good point, yeah. So with regard to food halls, when you're running multiple brands under the same roof, how do you protect against a brand's quality over their products? You know, how I know that there's probably going to be a lot of American brands who might come into Canada to do this kind of virtual setup to get customers exposed to their brand. How do you control that product quality and brand quality? Oren, how would you answer that?
So there are a few models that are happening today in kind of the ghost kitchen world. You have companies that are out there that are, they've taken control of the full process. So they'll license a brand or create a brand from scratch. They'll do multiple of them. They'll set up one big kitchen with maybe one, two, or three lines, and they'll have staff cross-trained. They'll handle the whole process. They'll cook all the food. They'll put it all online. They'll sell it under different menus. They'll sell them all together under a food hall store. And that model can work, but what we found and what the reason why we chose a different model, the model that we chose was to allow restaurants to come in and have their own cooking space, to have their own staff, to source the products that they are used to working with. We felt that that would provide the restaurants with the opportunity to put out a better quality product, because we just don't believe that the same staff member could cook a great pad thai and then turn around and cook some great, you know, smoked ribs. Like we think that there's an opportunity for that, but there's a limit to how much you can do. And for us, it was giving restaurants an opportunity to come out and bring the same quality that they have in their existing restaurants to a new space and do it on delivery and takeout. And then yes, they can explore with, you know, one or two more brands, but we think there's a limit to it.
So have you seen that operators are comfortable with that, or have they been a little skittish about that transference?
In our experience, there's just a wide variety when it comes to restaurateurs, and everybody's opinion is a little different. Our experience is that, with some of the restaurants, they're there to do their brand and they want to do it as best as possible. And, for them, it's how do we create maybe other virtual offshoots, but of similar cuisine? And then others are a little bit more open to saying, okay, we can do, this cuisine really well. What does our equipment allow us to do? What else does our equipment allow us to do? Can we start doing breakfast? Is there a breakfast brand we can build? So I think it's operator dependent. I think, like I said, there's an opportunity for restaurants to explore different ways of creating more different foods and concepts, but there's going to be a limit to how much one employee or one line can do and still put out consistent quality.
Okay. John, would you like to add to that from an operator standpoint?
It's a challenge because, food, just like coffee, generates every second it's finished cooking. But we always have to work to thrive to make sure that the operators are pulling out that quality as much as possible. And, to Oren's point that, menus get modified, there's not too much lettuce near, juicy proteins, and that causes that thing to drip all the way when it gets home. There's no, so you just have to really create a lot of trial and error on your food and how it's delivering.
Okay. So given the impact of COVID-19, consumers really want to, more than ever, I think they want to be assured that safety protocols are respected and adhered to. How do you control food safety audits in a ghost kitchen format? I mean, most restaurants in the marketplace are inspected by food safety inspectors a few times a year. How is that treated in this kind of virtual setup? Are they still inspected in the same way? Is the frequency any different? Because I think moving forward in this new environment of safety, I think consumers probably will want to know that sort of thing. So, George, maybe you can address that.
I actually think, Oren, maybe you're better suited to walk through maybe some of the requirements from a ghost kitchen standpoint.
Yeah, happy to do so. A ghost kitchen is inspected exactly the same way that a traditional brick and mortar restaurant is inspected, at least in Ontario. And so we have a dine safe license. We get regular inspections. We follow all of the same guidelines as a regular restaurant would. That means that, hand washing procedures, the temperatures of fridges and freezers are inspected and closely monitored. We have, because we are supporting multiple restaurants, we've put in best in class technology to make sure that from a safety perspective, we are going over and above what typically a restaurant would do. So, we have monitoring of our fridges and freezers all by Wi-Fi. If something goes down, we know within seconds. We've also designed our space for limited interactions with the outside world, right? So in our space, all the food is delivered to the front, and then someone can come in just to the front reception area and take it out. So for us, you know, in terms of precautions that we put in place, we were essentially built for this, and then added in a few extra precautions like masks and that kind of thing. But in terms of glove wearing, hand washing and all that stuff, it's already there and it's already being inspected, and we're already expected to adhere to the stringent guidelines that public health has set out for all restaurants.
Okay, well, that's good to know. With a lot of restaurants, probably, you know, we don't know what the fallout will be until this crisis is over, but I'm sure a lot of restaurants will be forced to close after this health crisis. And undoubtedly, there's going to be a lot more restaurant spaces available. Is there a special type of space that is more suited to having a ghost kitchen? I know some of these kitchens are situated in more of the suburb location. Is that a case that the suburbs work better because of space size, or, you know, what's your feeling on that in terms of what kind of space works best? And maybe George, you could answer this.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that there's like a few very important criteria to look at when you want to open up a ghost kitchen facility, or even, you know, as an operator that wants to shift more of their business to delivery. When you think about some of the components that made restaurants attractive historically, or site selection attractive historically, might be, you know, higher priced retail with strong foot traffic, and that's not really the case for these delivery platforms. So I think if a restaurant's looking to enter the space or expand their footprint, it's more important to look at the delivery apps that service that area, how popular they might be in that area, which there's multiple studies that you can look at online to see what the penetration looks like in different markets, and more importantly, what the delivery demographic looks like for that specific area, because what used to be attractive from a site selection standpoint is much different at a delivery only capacity. I think that there's opportunity outside of what we used to call tier one or tier two markets. And the reality is that, you know, everyone consumes about 20 meals a week. And so even markets that might not look attractive actually could be very attractive. And it's more important to understand the delivery app performance in that area and actual supply, and then understand if maybe there's unmet demand for the cuisine that you're offering or plan to offer in the ghost kitchen delivery only capacity.
Okay. Oren, did you want to add to that? I know your location, I believe you're out in Etobicoke, right?
Yeah. So, you know, to add on to that, I think, you know, George actually mentioned this a little bit earlier. A typical restaurant dedicates around 70% of the space to dine-in and seating. And in a ghost kitchen or a delivery and takeout focused business, you really don't need that. Most of your space needs to be dedicated to the kitchen, and, you know, a lot less to the customer facing side of things. So, you know, if you look at a typical Domino's, which, you know, I may have heard George say this before, but somebody's going out and saying Domino's is probably the first ghost kitchen. And that's because if you think about what Domino's does, is it's a focus on delivery. With it, if you go to their space, it's probably 80% kitchen space and storage and fridges and freezers, and then 20% delivery. And, you know, that's the kind of physical structure you need for delivery and takeout. And we are building a way to do that and empower other restaurants to be able to do that and to do it even more efficiently, because they can share some of that space that, you know, is required but doesn't necessarily add to the bottom line across a few different brands.
So Oren, in your space specifically, how many brands are you working with?
We are working with, we have five brands that have their own storefronts, and then we have three that we control where we sell all of the other brand, all of the brands that exist within our space, and a variety of other, you know, consumer packaged goods that we've partnered with.
And would most of those brands be focused on the lunch and dinner day parts exclusively, or do you have any breakfast in there at all, or no?
We don't currently have any breakfast. It's an area that we'd like to see somebody expand to. What we can say today is, you know, the vast majority of delivery happens at dinner. Of course, there are lunch brands that do really well on these platforms, and there are breakfast brands that do really well on these platforms. But in terms of eyeballs that open up the app, the majority of that is happening at 6 p.m. Happening more on the weekends than during the week.
Interesting. And George, from your experience in the U.S. market, are they doing it a little differently from what we're doing here, or is it pretty much the same on a bigger scale?
Are you talking about in terms of like the day parting and cuisine types, or?
Well, the virtual halls, you know, like are there more virtual like food halls as opposed to maybe one-offs or that we're seeing here?
Yeah, I think there's definitely been more expansion here in the United States. You have some companies that are very well capitalized in cloud kitchens and in Kitchen United, which are planning to expand to hundreds of facilities over the next couple of years. So I think the growth here is similar in terms of how that growth's happening. The popularity of virtual, it's probably just a bit accelerated. And that's both from an infrastructure standpoint and also just from a like virtual brand participation standpoint. I think Uber alone launched 4,000 virtual restaurants on their platform last year. And then, when that is now being coupled with the underlying infrastructure, it I think makes a lot of the unit economics work, both for the marketplaces and the restaurants, will just yield much greater expansion in 2020 and beyond.
So do you think we can expect to see more U.S. brands filtering into Canada under this new model?
Absolutely. When you look at how much easier it is, you know, this kind of goes back to a lot of the upfront capital contribution, but also just the way that restaurants can now enter markets by partnering up with facilities like Kitchen Hub, it makes a lot more sense for operators here if they don't have to actually go and do the build out themselves. The marketing component's largely handled by way of these third party marketplaces. So the friction to enter in, let's say a U.S. brand to enter in the Canadian market, is drastically reduced. And on top of that, where historically a national brand, a landlord, let's say, might want a national brand to do a 3, 5, or 10 year commitment from a leasing standpoint, you can now enter in these facilities and have, as little as a year long or less commitment. So it makes it much more attractive for a U.S. brand to want to enter the Canadian market and test things out.
Makes great sense. John, on the flip side of that, as a Canadian operator, do you see yourself maybe entering the U.S. market in a more pronounced way because of this kind of setup?
We're in talks right now with people in the U.S. to bring our system into virtual kitchens.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it's easier talking to, it opens a conversation because there's existing restaurants already.
Of course, no, it makes more sense. It makes expansion easier on both fronts for sure. So as a last question to all three of you, what piece of advice would you offer operators who are looking at this trend and maybe are considering getting into ghost kitchens to some degree, especially after this COVID-19 is over and the market recovers? What are some words that you would offer to them as advice? And we can start with Oren.
Yeah, I think COVID-19 has brought, you know, these new business channels, these new revenue channels, really into the limelight, and has forced some restaurateurs to start thinking outside of the box. And I think if you are in the restaurant business and you're thinking that, you know, things will go back to normal, I'm not sure that'll be the case. And so
what is normal?
Yeah. So what is going to be the new normal is really what people are talking about. So as you think about your business, there are a lot of new channels that you can adapt your business to. And not only do these new channels present incredible opportunity, they present a way to diversify your business so that the next time something happens like this, whether it's a recession alone or a pandemic or some other, you know, major, you know, force majeure to happen, think about the ways that you can adapt your business so that you can withstand these types of things. And delivery and takeout is one of them. Direct to consumer strategies are another. Meal kits are another. There's a lot of opportunity out there, and delivery and takeout definitely is something that has now, as one of the heads of one of the apps put it to us last week in a call, it's fast forwarded 3 to 5 years.
That's a huge number of years. That's incredible. And George, from your perspective, what would you like to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few major recommendations that I'd have for restaurants, either existing operators or people looking to get into the space. The first is creating a brand that's designed for delivery is unique and much different than creating a great dine-in experience. So there's kind of the experiential dining that's much different than maybe just food consumption. And so the first thing that I'd encourage is that restaurants really think about what makes a great digital dining experience or delivery experience, and crafting the menu and the packaging to support great quality through travel and at home. The second piece that I'd recommend is just that this is especially for existing operators to be very open-minded about these changes, because it'll serve them much better in the long term. And I think all of these new market evolutions that relates to virtual brands and now host kitchens are very new and maybe seemingly weird. But what I often encourage restaurants to think about is how weird it was when Airbnb said that they were going to let you share a spot on your couch with a stranger. And so the restaurants that can like adopt this open-mindedness and understand that, like, hey, it might not be weird to have my existing restaurant be a host kitchen that has another brand in it that's just made for digital or delivery experience. And then the other two components is that it's very different. Marketing on these third-party delivery apps is very different than your traditional forms of marketing. So I'd encourage anyone looking to get in the space to really understand end-to-end these different delivery marketplaces, their offering, how competitive the market might be, and what their fully loaded cost is going to be as it relates to commission and all the marketing spend. And then the last component, which I touched on earlier, is around the importance of building a direct connection with your guest. If you're going to go and have a really good third-party marketplace strategy, that needs to be coupled with a really strong direct strategy through your own website and your own apps as well.
Well, that was great. You've really given us a lot to think about from an operations point of view. So thank you for that. And John, what's your parting advice for operators who are looking to get into ghost kitchens?
Well, I think George hit it right on. I think every point is spot on. And they have to understand, we have to go back to understand who the consumer is, what the consumer wants, and how they're going to get that to them in great tasting form. And all the other points that George mentioned are right on as far as supporting that.
Wonderful. Well, I think there's definitely, all of you have given us a lot to think about and to consider. And I think obviously we're living through very challenging times, but I think post COVID-19, we're probably going to see incredible change to the restaurant landscape, both here in Canada and in the US. But it's also very exciting. As scary as change can be for everybody, I think there's a lot of great opportunities that all three of you have touched on. So thank you for your insights. Thank you for your time. I know how difficult a period this is. And for you to take the time out of your busy schedules is truly appreciated. So thank you very much. Good luck in your endeavors. And I look forward to talking in maybe 6 or 7 months to see what happens post-COVID and to see how this trend has played out. So thanks again for all your time and stay safe.
We appreciate you joining us for this episode of the Table Talk Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love for you to rate and review our show. Also, make sure you never miss an episode by clicking the subscribe button. For additional resources related to today's episode, please visit our website, foodserviceandhospitality.com. Until next time.